And hello everyone, welcome to Trolling with Logic. It's 17th of March 2013, it's 6 o'clock in the UK, 2 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm your host and tech man for the evening, Zulu Fight Runner, and we are a live call-in blog TV show. Also, the audio of this show is uploaded for a podcast. We talk about issues of atheism, secularism, and anything else related. And just to a very quick announcement before anything else, as you are all aware, on 24th of March, Blog TV will be no more as it's merging with YouNow. Now, we have looked at YouNow and it's not a practical solution for us. So what we are doing is we'll be moving to Vaughan Live on the 31st of March, and our guest then will be Dan Barker. Please go down below to the playground, click the link there to follow, sign up for an account. All you need is an email address, very simple, then follow us, and we hope to all see you over there. Also, bear in mind, we do take live calls. Add the contact Trolling with Logic to your Skype, and please remember, if you do call in, you are granting us permission to use your likeness, because the show is recorded, then uploaded to YouTube and iTunes for later viewing. So without further ado, I'll introduce my panel. Our Texan Terror, Casey.
Harry.
And we have a miracle today, a sober Irishman on St. Paddy's Day, Kitch.
Oh,
yes, how can you live with the shame? And the Swedish Iceman, as always, Marty.
Hi, everyone.
And we'll hand over to the Velociraptor. He's got something to say, and then the introduction of our special guest. So take it away, Lundy.
Thank you very much, Lulu. So on the last show, I said something that I now regret, and I didn't know that I said at the time. At the time, we were discussing gay marriage, and I was telling my opinion about it. And I mentioned that, you know, if we were to get rid of the entire governmental institution of marriage as it is and just have the private contracts between different people, anyone can get married and have any sort of off-the-wall, whatever marriage that culture usually looks down upon, two men, two women, three men, and then five more women, and then blah, blah, blah. I also mentioned those who are transsexuals, people who are, and I believe I used the word she-male in my description of these, of other kinds of people who I'm not totally sure what exactly to call them. And I didn't know that I used the word she-male, and it slipped off of my tongue, and it never registered after that. And it is a word that I regret using. It's a word that I don't want to use in the future, and it's a word that I'm now conscious of myself to not use and make sure that I don't use in the future. So I apologize to anybody that I may have offended concerning that. And before I introduce our guest, I have one more announcement. There is a video currently on YouTube by Colin Mason. I believe that's how you pronounce his name. Not totally sure. It's called Climate Changes But Facts Don't, Debunking Moncton. It's a 2-hour-long video going over a debate that Moncton had early, I believe, last year. And it just line by line goes through everything that Moncton says, everything that his opponent says, and just trying to clarify all the facts for you guys. It's a very good video. It's very well researched. It's very well done. I'll go ahead and link it for all of you. And there it is. So, without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and introduce our guest. So, our guest is a popular blogger, popular atheist blogger, popular secular blogger, who has written at least 3 different books, the first being in order of how I've seen them, The Young Atheist Survival Guide, Helping Secular Students Thrive, The Friendly Atheist, Thoughts on the Role of Religion in Politics and Media, and the ever-popular I Sold My Soul on eBay, Viewing Faith Through an Atheist's Eyes. Ladies and gentlemen, popular atheist blogger and author, Hemant Mehta.
Hey, guys. Thank you.
Yeah, welcome to the show.
Good to have you on.
And I think,
my pleasure.
As always, Lundy, I think you can probably take away with the first questions.
So one of the big things that usually comes up whenever somebody sees you is... sorry, hold on a second.
Are you still there, Lundy?
one of the big things that usually comes up, great start to the show, when people interview you is the one book that you made that was actually fairly popular was the I Sold My Soul on eBay. Just the whole story behind that, what ended up happening as a result of it. Can you go ahead and explain, like, how you got the idea, how much it actually sold for, and the experience of what happened after that occasion.
Sure. Yeah, the short version is I was raised in a religious household, but it wasn't a Christian household. And so, long story short, when I had been an atheist for a number of years, and I'd never been to a Christian church. So I put up on eBay something that basically said, you can bid on where I go to church. I'll donate the money to charity. It's not about that. But you can bid on where I go to church. I thought that'd be an interesting way of getting people interested in this, because you don't want to write about what you see at church if no one's going to read it. And a pastor won the auction, and he said, instead of me sending you to church for like, I think basically a year's worth of Sundays, which is what he bought me for. He bought me for $504, actually. And he said, why don't you go to a bunch of different churches around Chicago, where I'm from, and he'll pick them out for me. I'll go there, and I'll write about my experiences on his ministry's website. And that's what ended up happening. And the posts that I made on his site turned out to be really popular, because a lot of Christians really want to know what an atheist thinks about their church, because they're trying to reach out to me. They're trying to convert me. And a lot of times, they don't like the churches I go to because, you know, they don't represent true Christianity, quote unquote. And so a publisher caught wind of this, and they said, we'll send you to more churches around the country. And that's what ended up becoming the basis for I Sold My Soul on eBay.
Well, that's awesome. You wrote a lot of your experiences on the churches that you went to. From what I recall, looking at the different posts and also reading people's responses to your book itself, the posts seem to be about how the pastors in the different churches would explain their message, how they would appeal it to a general audience. And some of them did it well, some of them didn't do it well. You recommend some take from others, learn from others in certain ways. What would you say are the positive points of the churches you went to and some of the more negative points?
I mean, look, they're not going to win us over on their logic and their arguments. I mean, they're just not. So what else do they have going for them that might actually be appealing to an atheist? And I think, you know, if they can deliver a message that makes me think once I leave, you know, their building, that's a good sign. And some of the bigger churches, the ones that you think of when you think of like mega churches, they have better pastors. They have pastors who are better at communicating and speaking, and they really know how to get you in their grips, basically. So I was totally taken in by some of that. I mean, when you leave there saying, okay, you know what, I don't really care for the Bible references, but it is important to think about how you live your life. That's a powerful message. I mean, Joel Osteen, whose TV show about his sermons are really popular, my mom loves watching them, he really doesn't go into theology and like you're all going to hell. He just says, you know, if you believe in the Bible, look at what good things are going to happen in your life. And you could totally listen to his message outside of a biblical context and still get something out of it. I think that's effective. I really didn't see that many fire and brimstone services. So I saw a lot more of people just trying to connect whatever the Bible teaches in their interpretation with how we ought to be living our lives. And that's going to be hard to argue against if I'm an atheist. I mean, it's hard to say, well, this church is a bad place. They taught you that you should help other people. Like, I really can't go against that, even if it's for the wrong reasons.
Obviously not. I had a similar experience growing up when I still went to church. I grew up going to a Methodist church. Did the whole Sunday school thing, did the church thing usually after Sunday school. I was part of a little bit of a youth group that they had going on. I was fairly big into it. And at the time, what the pastor would do in pretty much every service, the services that I pay attention to, generally they would hand out pamphlets for the little kids to like do crossword puzzles and grab while the adults would actually pay attention. But the ones I would listen to, generally she would try and think up nice little parables to inspire everybody in their day-to-day lives, try and make it, the teachings of Christianity a little more relevant to your average person. And I think that is probably the best thing they can do to, if not convert people, at least keep people in the church as a result, because they go, they experience a decent atmosphere, they're not being yelled at, that they're all horrible people that need to burn hell. So it's a lot more likely that they're going to stay and they're going to get something out of it. It's a big community feel, I think.
Yeah, it was. And it's so easy for atheists to say, you know, if we just say the right things, if we have the right arguments, people will lose their faith in God and leave the church. And that is so short-sighted, because what these churches offer isn't just this idea that the Bible is true. It's a whole community. They will take care of you if you lose your job, if your kids need babysitters. I mean, all of that these churches can take care of. And so if you're asking people to leave the church, convincing them that God doesn't exist is only step one. You got to give them, you know, a replacement in a lot of cases. And we're really bad at doing that.
Well, because we don't really offer a replacement. That's the issue. We don't. It's just like, well, now you don't have a God, and now you really can't replace it with anything. So what are you going to do?
Exactly.
As far
right.
as the whole community feel, I think the only thing that we could possibly do is form, you know, little communities of people who are like-minded, who say, hey, let's get together. Let's be a little more united. Let's support each other in our day-to-day lives
right.
and explain, you know, how we are able to go around doing the things that we do, what inspires us, all these kinds of things. I think that's probably the best thing that we can do.
Right. I mean, we need to do a better job of it. I mean, you've seen it in London right now. It's really popular, this Sunday assembly, like the atheist church on there. And why? Because it gives atheists a chance to have that community feel without any of the BS that comes with church. So, you know, more power to them for making that work.
But isn't there a risk that when you start talking about an atheist church, that sort of adds fire to the whole atheism as a religion thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to, but again, who cares? I mean, look, anyone who says that is wrong. We know that, because we're not making people believe anything in particular. We're just saying, look, if you agree with us, we can give you a lot of what you got out of church, but we're not going to make you adhere to this mythology. We're not going to make you get baptized in some weird way. We're just saying, look, if you want to be around people who are rational and like-minded, we're going to do it, and we're going to have fun doing it. And we'll do it at the time when, we know you're free. There's nothing special about Sundays. You know, Christians don't own that. Yeah. They don't own getting together and celebrating anything with friends. We tend to think of those things as very church-like, but it's not. That's just people getting together. So, I mean, look, I know it's an easy knock to say, well, it's too much like church. But for a lot of people who are on the verge of, like, I don't believe in this, I might believe in this, that's a nice transition for them.
Yeah, sure. I can see that.
My whole thing concerning these different groups is just we have – There's clubs for just about everything that you can think of. Especially when you're in like high school, there's clubs for everything. There's like chess club, there's video game club, there's like computer club. There's like everything that you can think of, and these people get together. They're all like-minded, and they get together for a common interest. So, what really is the difference substantially between a bunch of like-minded people who all don't believe in a God game together and not really just saying, it's not like we're offering a group of people to get together and go, hey, you don't believe in God, neither do I. Let's go ahead and not believe in God together. That wouldn't really lead to anything. It's more of it's a friendly atmosphere for people who enjoy talking about the same type of subject.
Right. I would gladly listen to those atheist church sermons where they talk about how awesome science is than hearing how we all should be like, you know, Jesus, blah, blah, blah. Same stuff we've heard many, many times before.
The only issue I have with the idea of like, I understand that they would be appealing to those who are rational and those who are okay, who are good with science. But you know, you'll always find a nice little subgroup of atheists who are pretty anti-science on a number of different issues. I mean, you got the conspiracy theorist atheists. You've got climate change.
Don't mention those.
Vaccine denial.
You know what? And I haven't seen them promoting any of those wacky scientific fringe elements either. But again, what's the point here? The point is you want to give people – it's very appealing to have this community. I mean, we know these churches are doing good, and it's not because every single person in that church believes wholeheartedly everything the pastor says about the Bible. They're doing it because they really get a sense that people in that church care about them. Even people they don't know are bonded together by the fact that they go there. That's not a Christian-only type of thought. That is something that's just, you know, humanity in general. So if we can provide that for them without the rest of the nonsense that, you know, that's the stuff we pick on, no one's knocking churches for being nice to each other. They're knocking churches for spreading bad ideas. So let's get rid of that. Let's replace that. And only for the people who like it and need it. No one's saying you have to go there to be a, you know, true atheist. It's just saying, look, if you like that sort of thing, we'll offer it to you. That's a good idea.
Yep. Casey, you had a question?
Oh, yes, I did. So what exactly are these atheist churches? Well, anything else? What else do they do?
I haven't been to one myself. I've only read about them online, but my understanding is they sing songs that appeal to people. They might have a quote-unquote sermon that is talking about the beauty of science or how we could live our lives or something. And as far as I know, that's about it. I think they're trying to expand into volunteer work, too, do some charity work, but they're not at that point yet. I could be wrong about that stuff, though, so...
So it's kind of like church without the God and the Jesus.
Pretty much. And again, for a lot of people who have been to those services, and especially people who left their churches and are, you know, just brand new atheists, that's an amazing feeling to be part of a community like that.
Works for me.
Okay.
One of the other books that you wrote was The Young Atheist Survival Guide.
Yeah.
Secular Students Thrive. Can you go ahead and just kind of give some of the advice that you give in the book here, or just give people a little bit of an excerpt of what exactly you would, the advice you would give?
Sure. I mean, in general, this is almost piggybacking on the atheist church idea. When you're in high school or college, especially in America, there is a huge stigma with being an atheist. And we've seen over the past several years how powerful it is to have atheist groups on college campuses just to break stereotypes that a lot of Christians and other religious people have. They're good for starting conversations and starting debates. And that's really why what you want to see in school. You want people to trade their ideas back and forth and may the best one win. What we haven't seen a lot of is that same type of philosophy applied to high school students. Now, those schools in America, anyway, have every right, just like colleges, to have atheist clubs. But we haven't seen that many of them. And just think of what would happen if, especially in the Bible Belt and very conservative states, if there were a group of atheist students who got together and just talked about what it means to not believe in God in their community, to raise questions about what their pastors may teach them or what their parents teach them. And just to have a nice, not anti-religion, but just, hey, we're atheists, we have doubts about faith, and let's talk about that. And that's the age when you really start thinking about these things seriously. We're starting to see those groups grow. And what I talk about in the book are, you know, look at some of the students who have been out in the public as atheists. Look at the hell that they have to go through in some cases when they try to fight about it, when they try to fight back against prayers at graduation, or, you know, a teacher who preaches creationism. When they stand up and fight back against it, they're pretty much alone. And that wouldn't happen if there were these groups there ready to support them. I think we've gotten better at helping those students, but it is really hard for them in a lot of places still around the country. So the book talks about some of those stories of kids who have been harassed because of their atheism. Students who have started groups and the benefits they got from it, how administrators and teachers and parents can all help. You know, even if you don't believe, even if you're not an atheist, you could still support the idea that these kids need support and they need help, and you could be there to stand up for them.
Okay, I think we've got a caller. Jay, are you there?
Yeah, you can hear me?
Yes, so ask your question to Hammond.
Hello.
Hi, teacher.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good.
You put incredible point about the lack of affection community in atheist group. You said the church give the theist community full of affection and it's care. Of course, with a lot of love and all the silly and stupid things come from religion. But on the other hand, we are lack of that community. Do you think we need put more offer to make a better community?
I think the question is, what do we need that better community and stuff? I hope that's right. Yeah, I mean, yes. It's going to be helpful. There are people who would benefit greatly if we had those available. Again, I don't even know that I personally would be a part of that because I don't know if I need it that much because I have other venues to talk about my atheism. But for a lot of people who are leaving church and who want to explore atheism in a way that they really can't do, just reading a book isn't the same thing as being around people and having a discussion. And for the people who really need that, having that venue available would be great. And that's all I'm suggesting. I'm saying it would be a really nice idea. I hope the Atheist Church, the Sunday Assembly, does spread, because I think it would help a lot of people. Like I said, I don't even know if I would personally attend one, but I really like the idea, because I know it would help a lot of people.
I love the idea of the group of students, atheists, in the school, like a club.
Because yeah,
there is a mass club. Yeah, there is a lot of all kind of clubs, but there is no atheist club.
Right.
I think so. We need that.
It's perfectly legal.
We need that badly.
We do. And you know what? The problem is, I think a lot of students who are atheists, one, they're scared of starting a group because they know it's just inviting more backlash. But two, they don't even know they can have one. And the problem is, it's perfectly legal. All you have to do is start. If you have a drama club or chess club at school, you can have an atheist club. The Christians know this very well, and they have Bible clubs all around the country. And you know what? Good for them. They're welcome to do that, and they're doing what they need to do. We can do the same thing, but I think we need to educate more students that this is something they can do. So, and I also talk about in the book how we can help them do it, how we can get parents to encourage their kids, if they support their atheism, to start a group. If we have teachers who are atheists, and you know any students, encourage them to start a group, because it's good for everyone involved.
Yeah, because, you know, in teenage, children are so afraid from change. So if you encourage them to be free thinkers, even except to be atheist or not, it doesn't matter.
Right.
The point is to go to free thinker, and that's after that, if there are choice atheism as a thing, so that's good for them. But they need courage, and they need a good environment. And
yeah,
our
and
teacher,
they need teachers
so.
And administrators. Yeah, they need teachers and administrators who are going to support them too.
I was just going to say, oh, we've lost Casey. He was going to speak about this. Casey, are
Sorry.
You there? Casey.
I don't know. Is he there, Casey?
Casey?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, this is this is a subject you've got some experience on here.
Oh, yeah. I do. Well, speaking on behalf of former high school student at a Bible Belt school, well, I've actually not seen, as you know, I haven't seen any atheist clubs in the school, but of course, nor was there any Christian clubs. I guess I'm not sure, but I thought it was just part of the rules. But I do know one thing. I remember you talking earlier about, like, basically students can help, theists not have this bad thought on, atheists. And, I think it could work, because it has happened to me, like, such as in one of my classes. What happened was, I remember at the end of the year, this girl, she was the student, she was, I remember her saying out into the class that before she met me, she thought that atheists were just these cold-hearted people who didn't know and who were moralists and pretty much just didn't care. But of course, then after she met me, she learned that was not the case. And also, on the part about the prayer at graduation, I would agree that it does make people feel alienated. In fact, they have to have this, I've noticed they had to have this group, this group thought, and, even ones that weren't, Christian would have to be a part of the prayer because, I guess what happens is when you're part of during this graduation prayer, people don't want to be pretty much egged on.
Right.
Thinking that, while some people would have to participate because they didn't want to feel alienated, I pretty much just didn't. I'm not joining at all. And I would fight back against the school prayer because of how alienating it is, but of course, it's not against the Constitution to do it because it's student led. Now, if it was
And a lot of those things are debatable, whether they're really student led or if the administration is just kind of encouraging it. But again, if we're on the lookout for it, even if you don't know if it's legal or not, there are groups that specialize in these things, and we want to let students know, if you think there's something up, talk to, Freedom From Religion Foundation. Talk to the ACLU or Americans United. They'll help you out.
Yes. Yeah, I would do that, especially since I like Dan Barker. But moving on, I also do remember how over at my school, pretty much, when I would speak out about my atheism, sometimes people would question me about my morals and how evolution could have made humans. And yeah, it was the usual bunk.
Okay, we do have another caller in the queue. So, Jay, do you have another point, or are you okay to?
Okay. I have that question for you.
Okay.
How you put the line between you as a teacher and you as a person's belief of free thinker and as an atheist when you are in school?
Sure. When I'm working, I work as a high school teacher. When I'm in class, that's my job. I'm a teacher, first and foremost. I don't talk about atheism in the classroom or anything like that. And then when I get home and I'm, kind of on my private time, that's when I write the blog. That's when I do all my other work. So I don't know. The line is pretty easy to keep. I'm not trying to cross it. And so there's really no issue. There never has been.
Perfect.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks for the call, Jay.
Thank you. Bye, guys.
Good to have you on, Jay. Before we move on to the next caller, I just wanted to make a little bit of a tangential point. It's actually more of a story that happened to me when I was still in high school. I think it was a junior at the time. We had a Christian group that was generally run by pretty much everybody in my grade. Well, not everybody, but everybody who was in the group was in my grade. And they were having a sort of presentation that they wanted to do in the auditorium. Now, the people in the school, the administrators, the faculty and all them, they were pretty much saying, hey, you don't have to go if you don't want to. But there was a very clear undertone of, you probably should go because this is a Christian meeting and you should probably go because Christianity, So there was that whole thing. But it was pretty much just people in my grade that were being encouraged to go. And it was just me and one other person who didn't want to go. And the other person didn't want to go because he was a Wiccan. So that was kind of fun. So essentially we got put in a separate room where we just kind of watched a short movie. That's all we did. That was sort of our atheist club, kind of. But he was a Wiccan, so it's I'm really the only one.
And it's amazing. In a lot of schools, there are students who may not be Christian, but then they may not be atheists, but they all want some way to get together and talk about their beliefs of whatever they are. And this is why it's so important to start groups for students like these, because everyone else is already doing it. We're late to the party. We need to get on that. And we need students who are willing to go through the hurdles and make them start up.
When, for example, when I was in secondary school, a lot of us entered in, we're about 12 years old, 13, thereabouts, and we're all pretty much Catholic. But I think most of us were Catholic because of the confirmation money, bribery.
We can't hear you at all.
I can kind of hear him. It just sounds really far away.
Yeah, the quality is really bad.
Hold on. How about now?
Speak again, Kitch.
How about now?
That's better, yeah.
A little better.
Oh, okay, I'll just speak a bit.
Probably speak a bit slower as well.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, when we were in Catholic school, we were pretty much all going in 12, 13 years old. Just on our confirmation, you know, mostly probably were Catholic at that stage because of the bribery from the confirmation. You know, we were all talking about, you know, well, we got 100, 200 in it. Anyway, that's irrelevant. But by the end of our secondary school education, I'd say a good chunk of us were atheists. And you have to go to the graduation for a Catholic mass. And no one was happy about that. No one was happy. We all just wanted to go straight to the graduation, secular graduation. Pretty much screwed. Because, you know, they kept on saying, we don't believe in this. You know, no. But they're saying, oh, this is a Catholic school. There's nothing we could do.
Okay, well, I had trouble hearing that. Did anyone else?
It ended up coming out pretty mumbled.
Yeah, I didn't catch that.
Yeah, sorry, Kitch, it's really kind of, it sounds mumbled, really. Quite muffled, the sound. Anyway, we do have a caller, so we'll go to the caller, Kitch, and if you can try and sort out your mic. Mandalore, are you there?
I'm doing fine. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you loud and clear.
Just fine.
So, fire away. Mandalore?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, go ahead with your point.
Okay. I just wanted to mention about my background. I can assume you're from the UK?
Yeah, I'm from Scotland.
Oh, Scotland.
Ireland.
Alright. Now, we have a couple Americans in here, right?
One.
Yep.
We got a Scotsman, we got an Irishman, we got a Sweden, and I'm an Irishman, and I believe Hemant is in America.
Right.
Okay. Well, because I wanted to make the point about, I know y'all may have seen The Amazing Atheist when he mentioned the point about the U.S. states that have the most religious people have had the highest crimes, and blah, 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 blah.
Right. Right.
Okay. I'm from the most religious state, which happens to be the highest crime in the U.S. For those who don't know, that's the state of Louisiana, deep south, right by Texas. I used to be a very devout Christian, and just like a lot of other people around here. But, of course, within years of time, something didn't feel right, and I started looking to it. I actually not only read the Bible, but also read, like, the history of religion, started doing, you know, more looking through more secular books to find out what was wrong. And then I started to learn what was really wrong. And that's where I converted, deconverted from Christianity and went agnostic and then became atheist officially. And the main thing I come to realize is religion in general, not all religion, but Christianity in particular appears to be used as more of a form of control through fear, like an authoritarianism more than anything. Or at least that's how it's done where I live at. I don't know how it's done like in UK and Sweden and all the other countries.
Yeah, I can sort of agree with that. Like, I came from a probably one of the most religious parts of Scotland, and you know, the church was kind of a very authoritative thing in our lives. It kind of dominated our culture. Like where I was, like they were obsessed with the Sabbath observance, and you know, my parents wouldn't, they weren't particularly religious, but they wouldn't let me go out in case the church folks saw me outside the house on a Sunday. It would just be like a big social faux pas. So that's kind of my experience of that. I don't know, Hemant, do you want to comment?
I missed the first part of that question.
Mandel, could you just, I don't know, rephrase or just make it, you know, concise, one sentence, what you want to speak about?
Well, it's just, well, in general, like I said, I just only gave my background.
All right.
Saying I'm former Christian, just like everybody else, yeah, and deeply converted to atheism after learning about it further, yeah, which a lot of Christians usually do not do. Because, as yeah, you all know, they all say, you know, you gotta have faith. You just gotta have faith.
Right, but and also, you know what? Every time, you know, one of the things atheist groups do really well is they point out things in the Bible that people don't always know exists. I love it. Some college groups do like atheist Bible studies where they talk about certain books of the Bible, but from a skeptical perspective. Yeah. And it's awesome. I love Reddit for the same reason, because they highlight quotations you would never think are in the Bible. Yeah, they're silly memes or just images, but they point out some things that are in there that no one would have suspected.
Yeah. I was going to add to that, like one book in particular that's really good is the Brick Testament. I don't know if
I love that.
Yeah, that it's an amazing book, and it's fun. You should all go to Amazon and read the user reviews, and nearly every Christian objects to the sex and violence in that book. And he's saying, uh-huh, it's just the words of the Bible and I'm putting pictures to them, you know. How can you really complain about it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just a comic book, it's just a comic book version of the Bible, really, in a way. It's actually pretty funny. I like, for me, I was kind of the same way. But until I was about 10, I actually never even read the Bible. I just kept going to church and all that kind of stuff. I went to, you know, the whole Sunday school thing. Then they gave me my first Bible and I read it and I was like, holy shit.
Yeah, I think it's the same for everyone when they grow up Christian. When they actually read the Bible, they're really shocked at some of the things that are in there.
Yeah, Lundy, it's pretty much when you first read the Bible, it's literally everyone says the exact same thing.
Right. Can't hear it. There's a lot of noise.
I generally get that notion from everyone else who first reads it. Not those who've been, you know, in the movement of Christian for a period of time. Those who have been there until they were 20 before they read it. They'll come up with rationalizations. And one of the funny things is the Bible that they gave me was called an adventure Bible, which was kind of weird. It was a Bible specifically with like built-in apologetics. Like every time a questionable verse would come up, there'd be like a little note, and it's just like, go down to the bottom of the page or go to this page to find an explanation of this particular passage. So like,
when
you would have, you know, God hardening Pharaoh's heart, Pharaoh wouldn't let the slaves go. They'd be like, they'd have like a little star and be like, go to this page to find out why he did this. And then they'd have like a little built-in apologetics for it. And I thought that was kind of weird, like, why would the Bible need this? It's a perfect book. I don't understand why it needs this kind of thing going on.
I'm sorry if this is going to go off on a tangent, but yeah, what's the apologetic they gave for that one? Because
well, here's the funny part.
That was just stupid.
In the version of the book that I read, they actually didn't mention that God hardened Pharaoh's heart, though I knew that was actually in there. Well, they took that part out and said Pharaoh simply hardened his own heart and wouldn't let the slaves go. They said, well, why wouldn't he let the slaves go? And essentially they just had a huge paragraph about how Pharaoh was he felt he was a god, and if you are a god, you are not responsible to anybody, and so everything that he does is then right, by his own definition, so he can harden his heart and do that kind of thing. That's from his perspective. He thinks that's right. And clearly we know that's not right, and God would never allow that if he had the choice. Like, no, you took out the part.
All right. I think Hemant needs to, in a few minutes, you need to leave if I'm reading the chat right.
Mm-hmm.
There was one very quick question I wanted. Can you explain what the Foundation Beyond Belief was all about?
Absolutely. So one of the things that if you find out how much different faiths give to charity, religious groups are almost always at the top of those lists. And it's not just because they give tithes to their churches. They're just in a habit of giving. They give more to different causes. And I don't think it's because atheists are any less charitable or generous than these people. I think it's because religious groups tend to have very good vehicles for donating. They have a way to do it, and we really don't, unless we do it on our own. So Foundation Beyond Belief was created a few years ago by this guy, Dale McGowan, and I work with it now. And what the group does is it basically says, hey, look, we're going to vet some charities that you may not have heard of that really help the world in a lot of different ways, whether it's women's rights or poverty or animals' rights, things like that. You can choose which ones to support, but we're going to make it as easy for you as possible to not only donate to these groups, but to donate as an atheist with a group of other atheists, because we think that a lot of people will take part in that if we make it as easy as possible for them, more so than they might have done on their own. And so it's been about 2.5 years now almost, and we have raised more than $750,000, well over that. And these are this is money that has gone to these different charities. And every month we're giving away tens of thousands of dollars to these different groups, really making a difference in their organizations. And it's, you know, courtesy of, I guess, godless money, if you want to call it that. And it's awesome. It's just a wonderful organization. It's all about helping other people and not just, you know, ourselves. And that's an awesome cause.
What's some of the causes that it supports? If you can.
Sure. Let me get you the actual thing. URL, by the way, is foundationbeyondbelief.org. Our beneficiaries have included things like, you know, this quarter, we change it every 3 months. We've supported a group called Men Can Stop Rape, which is a human rights organization. We have done the Innocence Project, which is a popular one for a lot of people. It helps get DNA evidence for people wrongly convicted of crimes. The Equal Justice Initiative to really put a stop on putting people in prison, incarceration for a long time. Environmental and Energy Study Institute, the Diane Fossey Gorilla Fund. I mean, this is really a wide range of organizations, and you could see them on the website. But we've been doing this since 2010, the beginning of it. And you know what? As a kind of outreach, we even say one of the charities we're going to pick every month that you can choose whether or not to give money to is an organization that is run by religious people, but it is not a religious organization. They don't spend any money proselytizing. They just happen to be religious people doing awesome things. We call that Challenge the Gap. So this quarter we're doing Buddhist Global Relief. And we support what they're doing, and you know they're using the money for good reason. So check out the website, foundationbeyondbelief.org, and if you like it, be a part of it. I mean, we got so many members right now. We have over 1,000 members that give every month, and just a really good group of people.
Before we move on to the next couple of questions, I just want to address something that's been going on in the chat for a little bit. It's died down a little bit, but I want to go ahead and bring it back up. There is a user named Pure Rock. He's one of the guests in the chat. He essentially went over what he feels to be the issues that he sees in society today as far as indoctrination goes. He went over the idea that indoctrination is the giving of any sort of text or ideology as if it is sacrosanct, as if it cannot be questioned, and it is ultimately right no matter what. And then he says, and it applies that the thing is forced upon the passive receiver as sacred or unquestionable, much like Catholics, leftists, Muslims, feminists, born-again atheists do. He defined what a born-again atheist is earlier on in the chat, and he said essentially a born-again atheist is somebody who says, I know that there is no God. I am fully aware that there is, in fact, not a God. I know very few atheists who do this. I don't think anybody on this panel does it. I guess the maximum I would go in that notion is, depending on the definition of the God that you're using, I can say whether or not I can substantially know whether or not that God exists, but I can't know that there is no God whatsoever. Because there's just so many different definitions, and some of them are rather vague and unaddressable, such as a deistic God or anything like that, just as an example. He said, for real world examples, look there as far as, and I got a little perturbed because he included leftists and feminists and stuff in there. And it seems to me that he's simply saying any ideology that anybody holds is something that to be ashamed of because you are holding to it dogmatically, which is never universally the case, as far as I am aware. It's never universally the case that if one is a feminist, they will always be a feminist, and they will become extreme in their feminism, and it is just, feminism is the only thing to focus on, blah, blah, blah. I know people who have been on the left on the political scale who have gone to the right. I know people who were on the right who have gone to the left. There's plenty of wiggle room. There's plenty of gray area of people who don't take this kind of stuff dogmatically. And if you're going to pretty much say that any label that anyone puts on any ideology can be equivalent to any dogmaticism, I have to say we have a little bit of an issue because then that prevents anyone from getting anything done ever.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, people pick fights about anything and everything, and it's a lot easier to just ignore them in a lot of cases. I mean, I know what I believe. I don't need – whether or not I use a label to describe it, it doesn't mean it's dogmatic. It doesn't mean I agree with everything everyone has ever said on the subject, you know. So I don't know. I don't take those seriously.
It's interesting that he said leftists were indoctrinated or dogmatic or whatever it was. What about people on the right?
I brought that up in the chat. I said, okay, what about conservatives? And he goes, well, do you consider – I know conservatism exists in America. Do you consider them dogmatic? Because if they are dogmatic, then sure, they are dogmatic. Like, that's just a tautology. If they are dogmatic, then they are dogmatic. But the same thing can be said towards the leftists. So if you're going to point out the leftists and not point out the right-wingers, and then I point out the right-wingers, and you go, well, if you want to call them that, it seems to me that there's a little bit of a bias going on.
Sorry, Lundy, we've got to interrupt you mid-flow, but I think Hammond has to leave at this point.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for having me. And hey, if anyone has any questions for me that they didn't get answered, my website is friendlyatheist.com. The contact information is all on there, and it's always fun to hear from people. So thank you so much for the invite, guys.
Thank you very much for coming along. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for coming on.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Happy St. Paddy's.
They call you the friendly atheist.
St. Paddy's.
Happy St. Paddy's. See you.
You too.
Happy St. Paddy's Day.
You too.
Happy 8 Patrick's Day. You know that.
Okay, Lundy, I think we can let you go back into rant there.
Purox now going on and saying that he didn't say any sort of tautology and was never, if you want to call them dogmatic, then sure, they're dogmatic or whatever. Pretty much what you did, Purox, and I'll just go ahead and say this, is you essentially said that any label that anyone gives to themselves in order to label their ideology and they go for that ideology, you said, oh, that's dogmatic. No, it's not. It is simply a label that one puts on what it is that they think to save a little bit of time. That's it. That's all it is. That's all it's ever going to be. If you don't like labels in general, if you say, oh, labels are bad, well, then now you have a bigger issue, because what is your name? It's a label for you. So if you don't like labels, you might as well just abandon your name and be like, you can't call me anything if labels are bad. So now he's continuing on. You asked if conservatives are religious. I said if they submit to dogma as sacred, then yes. Okay, so if they are, I believe that you have essentially equated religion with dogmaticism. So if they submit to a dogma as sacred, then they are dogmatic. So if they are dogmatic, then they are dogmatic. That is
okay.
That is a tautology. I'm sorry that there is no escaping that.
All right. I don't think arguing with the chat room makes for a good show later on.
I don't know.
No, probably not.
There was one thing I wanted to update, like the Lawrence Krauss situation. Did everyone? I take it everyone's aware of it now.
Yep.
Yeah.
Basically, there was a follow-up to that Hamza Sortsis and his crew are now banned from the university from holding any more events.
Oh,
and another interesting thing was Hamza Sortsis' Wikipedia page has been deleted by Wiki. As they said, this man has not contributed anything of academic worth. He just repeats stuff from other academics.
What?
Yeah, Hamza Sortsis.
That is awesome.
Yeah. They just say he's just repeating stuff from other... Basically, they're saying what everyone else is saying. He's just an Islamic version of him.
William Lake Craig.
Yes, him. Yeah, that's the one.
An even less charismatic version, I would say. I mean,
you know, the high-pitched voice and beard do make it kind of a kind of weird parody.
It makes it very difficult to relate to the guy.
First and foremost,
Hamza. I've watched a few debates that Hamza's been in, and it seems to me after he gets off his first argument and his first rebuttal, after that, whenever if the other guy is doing at least fairly well against him, he usually just starts devolving into. So you can see that he has hatred towards the Islamic people, and he has some sort of racism that is in him, probably culturally. He's always getting into that. You hate my people, and you are a racist, and that's why you're wrong. He always does this in like every debate, especially the ones that he's losing.
Yep. Saw the Stephen Law one. I'm taking Stephen Law just. I don't know. Does Stephen Law even have to get out of first gear too?
Not really. I mean, it was so funny to actually watch that debate because Stephen was. You could tell Stephen didn't even feel like being there, and he didn't even have to try. He was already addressing audience questions within his opening statement, just going, "All right, I'll take a next question. What do you want to say?" It was really freaking hilarious. But he sat there and was like, I have absolutely no interest in anything that he said. Nothing he said is right. So what do you guys have to say about it? I'll go ahead and address you guys.
I think that's probably the best way to address people like that.
Yeah.
I mean, don't play their game.
Yeah. Well, I think in the light of the Lawrence Krauss incident, I think Hamza's kind of been exposed for what he is now. He sort of did have a shield that he wasn't really that well known, but I think now to the wider community his reputation's been exposed for what he is,
and it's a negative reputation too, so yeah. It's really bad for him no matter what. Like, sure, now you're fairly well known, but not in a good way,
and he still won't debate the rationalizer.
He won't debate the rationalizer.
No, he won't. He said he's kind of, it's weird, if you go to The Rationalizer, who is a fantastic YouTuber, does some excellent videos on Islam, I think it all started with when Hamza was on the infamous Magic Sandwich episode. I think we've all seen it.
The one where the
beheading.
The one where they had the Rationalizer on.
Yeah, and then Rationalizer came on and basically embarrassed him. And then said, I'm not going to do any more Skype calls. And then later on was found out he was. And he's flip-flopped back and forth. Like, he'll say he'll debate the rationalizer and then keeps pulling out all the time. So, but it would be awesome. It'd be awesome to see, because I've seen the rationalizer debate, and rationalizer doesn't take any shit off anyone.
Y'all watch the Magic Sandwich still?
Yes, we did.
I've not watched too many episodes of the Magic Sandwich Show because I find them all. I find all the episodes to be fairly boring.
Yeah.
And every once in a while, when they get a Christian on the call, they just abuse the hell out of them, and it's just so hard to watch.
Yeah, it is.
What about Arona in there?
Well, Aaron Ra, he's overly aggressive in how he approaches people. He's always interrupting them. He's always trying to make a lot of points, like bullet points, just saying them as fast as he can to get them out, not letting anybody talk. And he doesn't even let the other hosts talk. He gets visibly frustrated when the other hosts try to get in and go, but I have a point too. He's like, I'm trying to make my point.
Texas rage for you.
Yep. Yeah, that might be. Thunderfoot's pretty much the same way, I think, but anyway, let's not trash talk another show because it's just like assholes.
Yeah.
I recommend everybody go to his channel. He makes good videos.
Yeah, and
it's just absolutely.
Check out the Magic Sandwich Show. They do some good episodes.
Yeah, in fact, I do like how Arana, he taught me lots of things when I was, beginning my YouTube atheism.
Yeah, I mean, let's just say I think foundational falsehoods and why do people laugh at creationists are sort of. I mean, if you're an atheist on YouTube, whether you like those guys or not, they are must watch.
Yeah, and also DPR's very first series on Venom Fang X.
Yeah,
that's also true. Another classic. I mean, they have made some really important videos. All those guys.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Yes, even meeting the guy that was, had some relation to old Charles Darwin.
Yep. Any other points anyone wants to bring up? Like Lundy, you always have a point. Anyway, so.
I'm a big mouth asshole.
Yes. You're a philosopher, for crying out loud. I mean, if you can't get a philosopher to talk, what's the world coming to?
Well, let's not forget, this show does have a sober Irishman on Paddy's Day. So
yes.
So it's the first time for everything.
Well, yeah. No kidding. It is.
The philosophy thing, there's a video on YouTube that it was brought to my attention fairly recently, and I was thinking about responding to it, and I think I actually linked it in chat, and you weren't around. Let's see if I can find it here. A challenge to new atheists. It's from September last year, but like I said, I just noticed it, and I'll just read from the description here. sorry about this. Belief in God is a delusion, implies that God does not exist. You like to assert, you as in the so-called new atheists, like to assert the logical improbability of God's existence. My challenge to you is this. How do you know that it's improbable that God exists?
Depends on the definition.
And the definition of God, she actually gives a definition of God, it's the one that I'm sure you'll love.
Let me guess. Maximally great?
Bingo!
Maximally great, maximally powerful, maximally knowledgeable, maximally good.
So are we into ontological?
Here it is. I'm referring to what philosophers call a maximally great being. God is described as a person who is timeless, beginningless, and changeless. And caveat. No appeals to scientism, the problem of evil, or infinite regression. All these objections are illogical. What I was thinking about was like, can I do this by just, you know, accepting those caveats?
You can do it by accepting those caveats. It'll be a little more difficult, but there's other things you can do. You can appeal. There's plenty of different arguments you can give. I personally like Stephen Law. I've grown to love Stephen Law's example of using the evidentiary problem of evil, not the paradoxical problem of evil, which is essentially the problem of, okay, well, we have no reason to presume that this God is maximally good any more than we have a reason to presume that this God is maximally evil because of everything that we see around us, everything that we're capable of observing. So this God is as unlikely to exist as an evil God. If an evil God is absurd, then why is it not absurd for a good God who has the exact same amount of what you believe to be evidence to exist? If they have the exact same amount, one of them's absurd, one of them's not, so why do you believe in the other one that you don't think is absurd when it's exactly the same? That's something that I like. But she's saying, okay, here's the problem of evil. Well, okay, I don't know if she's talking about the paradoxical problem, but the evidentiary problem is still something that has not been solved as far as I'm concerned.
I think she's referring to the classic one, because in the video she says something about how she doesn't see any reason why there can't be a maximally great being and suffering.
To which
I would respond, although this would be breaking the rules of the challenge, that a maximally great being has already done away with all suffering.
You would think, and they actually have, as far as, you know, if you have the conception of heaven, which is supposed to be a place where there is absolutely no evil that's going on, you know, my whole thing is, if God can create a place like heaven that has no evil, that has nothing but goodness, that has nothing but pleasure, that has nothing but greatness for everybody who's in there, well, then why would he not make that what we experience here on earth as well? If he can do that, why wouldn't he make that everything? It doesn't seem to make any sense to me. And usually what's referred to is, oh, well, free will. He has to give us free will. So we, so what you're saying is we have no free will in heaven. That's what you're saying. Because that's, you're saying that's what causes the evil and free will. And if there's no evil in heaven, then clearly that means that there's no free will, logically, right?
But you can appeal to say that there is free will in heaven, right?
If there is free will in heaven, then they have a little bit of an issue. Like, okay,
No. I don't think you heard me. Who says we have free will in heaven? Do Christians actually say that, or do they just say we have free will? And
that actually
I
can't remember the names of the different philosophers, but there's different Christian philosophers that have debated this concept. There are some that say that it's absurd to say that there isn't any free will in heaven, which goes a little bit against the reputation given by, oh, what is his name? Plantinga. Generally, Plantinga's reputation of the problem of evil includes the free will argument, as well as giving a little bit of analytical philosophy, giving some logical lines, giving some equations, essentially, to show how it is at least possible for one possible world to exist where we have free will. There is evil, and God is still maximally good. Like, okay, but now we have the problem of heaven, because that is also perfectly good. So you're saying there's no free will in heaven, and many Christian philosophers say it's absurd to say there's no free will in heaven, because there ought to be if we're going to be enjoying ourselves. But there's the problem of identity when you take away the problem of free will. The problem of identity being, if you don't have any free will, then if you had free will at one point and then it's taken away from you when you get to heaven, then how can you say you're still the same person? I believe Tracy Harris brought this up on one of the episodes of The Atheist Experience, where she said when you put a lion in heaven and it has no free will to eat anybody, is it still really a lion? There's other arguments you can give, though. If you don't want to appeal to the problem of evil, there's other arguments you can give.
I had one that I was thinking about, which was if God is changeless, how can he be maximally great? Because it's greater to be able to do something than not to, right? I mean, of course, they don't define what maximally great means, but...
What I'm thinking is that
someone who is incapable of changing can't change from a state of not having done something to a state of having done it. So either God has already done everything, or he will never do it.
And also,
this kind of ties into what I was going to introduce as a possible problem. Okay. I don't think that that in itself would be a problem, but you can tie that into this, which is the omni versus omni argument. Generally, you look at omnipotence and you look at omniscience.
Yeah.
Maximal knowledge thing means, okay, he knows everything. Everything that's going to happen, everything that will happen, everything that has happened, he knows it all. But with his omnipotence, is he capable of changing anything that he knows is going to happen? I don't believe he does. If he did, then he didn't know that that was going to happen, because he changed what was going to happen using his own omnipotence. So you can either have one or the other. And if you take out one of them, you take out the maximally great definition entirely.
Yeah.
Oh, also, I get a question. Like, well, there was this one quote I remember hearing. Like, does God ever play dice? Like, does he take chances?
God doesn't play dice, isn't it, or something?
Yeah, that's the Albert Einstein quote when he was trying to say that he doesn't accept quantum mechanics and the various rules and methodologies involved with therein. He thought it was way too random, and he's like, this doesn't make any sense. The universe... He had a problem because he thought the universe should be able to be completely computerized. You should be able to reduce everything to equations, and it kind of screwed that up when we introduced quantum mechanics, because there's a necessary amount of uncertainty in just about everything that you try to write down. So you can't write an equation that completely and utterly maps out quantum mechanics too well, because it's too random in that sense. So he's like, okay, well, this doesn't make any sense, because clearly that's not the case.
By the way, Lundy, see this? I'm on to chapter 2 now after a month.
Chapter 2?
Yes, chapter 2. I'm
fine. Lord, Zula.
Yeah, I've finally managed the Waters philosophy chapter, and I'm on to discovering why philosophy matters.
Oh, dear. This is...
Don't worry. After a year, I'll be ready to flip burgers like the best of them. Sorry. I just can't... We can't resist the anti-philosophy jibes in here. Sorry. Well, I've got to get it out to me before we have Stephen Law on, or else I can't be doing that in front of him.
Yeah, go ahead. Tell Stephen Law. Oh, philosophers only flip burgers. Yeah, no, no, no. He's going to look at it. Oh, yeah, I remember when I did that, like, never.
Yeah. No, it is. It is hard work, but it's like I always say, if I'm having to read a page over and over, it's more likely I'm going to remember the stuff that they're telling me. So, like, it's like I say, it's hard work, but I think it's quite rewarding, some of the stuff I'm picking up in the book.
I've actually never read Philosophy for Dummies. What did you get from the first chapter?
It was just a breakdown of what it is, and like a very, very basic breakdown, like in just the different kinds of philosophy, like epistemology, ethics was the other one, and I can't mind the other one off the top of my head, but that was the two I remember. I know what epistemology means now, so. I mean, just how we know things are true, basically, isn't it? Epistemology.
I think that's actually something that should be taught in high schools.
Yeah.
I think epistemology is something that you ought to teach. That along with critical thinking, because epistemology, when you actually teach it, when people get a basic grasp of what it is, it helps you avoid certain pitfalls, and it helps you avoid certain arguments that you really that sound confusing at first, like. I hate bringing this up because I hate this argument with a passion, but presuppositionalism is an instance where if you understand epistemology, you can understand, oh, you have an issue too, and this argument is unsound and not valid. So you're screwed just as much as I am if we're going to go ahead and agree with everything you said. So that's epistemology helps you that in that way. It also helps you in a more practical way aside from just like debating about God and all that kind of stuff, because it helps you understand how you come to understand that anything you believe is actually true or not true. By the way, did they go over in that chapter?
Useful in teaching as well.
Did they go over in that chapter how difficult it is to reach what is known as truth or what is defined as truth?
No, it's just a very, very, that's a very basic introduction to what is philosophy they give. So I think there's a whole chapter in epistemology much later.
The issue I usually have with how people who are well-versed in epistemology like to talk about truth is that the general consensus has currently become we cannot actually have truth as it is defined, which is justified true belief, because there's no real way. Essentially, this breaks down into a 100% certainty deal. So unless you are 100% certain about something, which is something that no intellectually honest person can actually be, then you have an issue reaching truth as it's defined in epistemology. And as a result, we can only obtain it. It's weird. They separate knowledge and truth. Yeah. Knowledge is different from truth in some strange sort of way. I still don't quite understand it. But you can obtain certain levels of knowledge while never obtaining truth. It's weird.
Yeah, it's just, and there's kind of other, like, it goes through the grid illusion of colors, you know, the whole questions of are colors real and things like that. So, like I said, it's a bit mind-bending at the time, but it is interesting stuff.
They might as well have gone over whether or not a chair is a chair. You gone through the what is a chair thing? That's usually a basic philosophy, I think.
No, they haven't gone over that yet.
Oh, Jesus.
It's a tiny bit about Newton and how basically it was philosophy that led Newton to formulate a lot of his laws.
Oh, I remember my first class concerning epistemology.
Yeah.
Oh dear. Chairs. The professor brought in a little chair. It was a chair with wheels on the bottom, and it was a steel chair with padding on it. Essentially his chair from his office, and he said it in front of us and just went, is this a chair? And we looked at it and went, yeah. He goes, are you sure? What makes it a chair? And then we just went off on like, this took 2 weeks. 2 weeks of us coming in and talking about it for us to finally decide what we considered something to be a chair. And eventually the definition got broad enough that you could essentially roll a rock into the, roll a boulder in, sit on that, that would count as a chair.
I remember one time, well, I had a cousin, he told me this story about how he was in a philosophy class, and then then the teacher said, tell me how this chair is actually over here. And then,
And while people thought of all these things to say, my cousin makes 100 after writing only 2 words. What chair?
I remember that story. Yeah, what chair? That is so good. I remember that story. That actually made me laugh really hard.
And like I say, Lon, you've also got this book as well as a follow up.
Nigel Warburton, Philosophy of the Basics. That's actually, I believe that's probably going to be very good for. I would recommend that book possibly for anybody who's currently thinking about going into philosophy in college. Yeah. It'd probably be the best thing for you guys.
I remember Nigel Warburton. He's the head of the philosophy department at Open University in the UK.
Mm-hmm. And the only issue, you won't have this issue because you're in the UK, but. Okay, so in logic, there's different systems that are sometimes used, different systems of axioms that are used, and in Europe and in the West, there are different systems sometimes used as far as logic is concerned. And that actually caused a little bit of a problem. That caused a little bit of a problem when I think Wisdom in Nature 7 made a video a long time ago where he was criticizing something William Lane Craig said about how logic works. And some people came on to him and said, actually, you're wrong about this particular issue because of this. And they got into a bit of an argument there because when Seven was using a system that's generally used in the UK and William Lane Craig was using a system that's generally used in the US, and it essentially became a whole let's just agree to disagree thing. Which just tends to be the outcome of almost every philosophical discussion. Let's just agree to disagree.
Because, what I'm getting from the books is it's not so much about the answers, but like the actual methodology, isn't it, philosophy, basically, of thinking. Lundy?
Kitch is trying to say something.
We can't hear you, Kitch.
I was going to say philosophy is more about the journey than it is the destination.
Yeah, that's basically what I'm saying. It's like more about how you think about the questions than the actual answers you arrive at, isn't it, Lundy?
Sorry, what was that?
It's more about like how you figure out the questions rather than, you know, the hard definite answers.
Generally, I would say that that's the case. Yeah. There's a lot of instances of questions that exist that many philosophers will eventually come to the conclusion is a stupid question.
But it's just
like
more
right
of
now,
a...
there's currently a thing going out. What was it? Free will. Yeah. People argue about free will, and there are some philosophers who say that they don't find the question very good. When you argue about something over the course of 2,000 years and more, you're probably not going to come up with an answer. So maybe you're asking the wrong question. So they're kind of investigating the question of whether or not we have free will and saying, is there any substance to even be gained from this question in itself? And a lot of people are starting to come over to the concept of perhaps not. Perhaps we need to think of a different question to address what it is we're trying to talk about.
I have a question about that. What is free will supposed to be anyway? Because I tend to think of it like it should mean that nothing influences your decisions, which would mean that your decisions are completely random, right?
I was thinking that free.
Well, not necessarily. It depends on which stance you currently take in the whole free will "quote unquote" debate. You can be a compatibilist and agree that you have free will and it's not necessarily random. You could be a determinist to say that you don't have free will and nothing is random. You can say, well, not nothing, but like on a macroscopic scale, nothing.
Yeah.
And you can also be sort of a libertarian sense of free will believer. And you can say that, you know, there is no determining factor as to what you're going to do at any point, and it's all completely and totally up to you. I don't quite understand that one too much because I don't understand the mechanism that's being proposed as to how we are able to assert this will on the universe if it's not in any way dictated by the universe. It's really weird for me to try and understand that. I've been a compatibilist for as long as I've even known about the whole free will thing. I'm just like, well, we are controlled in a certain sense by the universe, by its machinations, by physics, by chemistry, by biology, by all these different things. But it does certainly feel like we have options when we're looking at different options.
Yeah, but one thing that I've been thinking about is like, take the last time, to take an example, the last time you ordered pizza. You could have picked any set of toppings from the menu. You picked this particular type of pizza. Could you have picked another one? Well, I mean, you picked the one you did for a reason, right? Your personal taste or whatever.
Yeah.
So did you have a choice? Or was it just that, you know, like, it's stupid, but I'm going to do it. Like they say in the shitty Matrix sequels, like, you already made the choice, now you just have to understand why you made it.
I would say
that... You see where I'm going with this?
I would say there's certainly an amount of outside influence to do with culture in terms of just taking the pizza out of you, because there are some toppings that you would never go for, but you might like, because, for example, in the local food court here, there's different types of curry, and one of the curries is fish head curry. I'm not joking. And I will never try that. I might like it, but there's no way in hell I will try it.
Yeah.
Yeah, my whole thing is,
so there was something manipulating you. You were being controlled by certain circumstances, whether it's culture or taste or whatever.
Yeah, and there's other problems that I can lodge at the example as well concerning whether or not we can say that we actually made the choice. Not that I'm saying that you're trying to lodge a problem against it, but there's a problem that is inherent within the hypothetical. What if you did pick a different topping? What reason did you do it then? If you went ahead and said, I'm a person who likes pepperoni and I hate anchovies, but to prove that I have free will, I am going to pick anchovies. Well, that actually
you did it just to prove a point.
Yeah, you did it just to prove a point. Now you have a different reason as to why you chose it instead of just your taste. There's something else dictating that aside from you. So even though it does feel like we have a choice, even though it always does like have this instance of, I am choosing blah, it cannot be substantially said that we are, in fact, saying blah. We are, in fact, choosing blah, whatever that blah may be. So, and that's only if you look at the universe in a sort of deterministic way. A lot of people who are atheists, for example, tend to see the universe deterministically. So the general argument between the two different positions is, either we don't have free will or what we have can actually be called free will. And whether or not that's a substantial enough definition of free will, it's usually between the compatibilists and the determinists that whole debate goes on. For me, I kind of figure that compatibilism seems the most likely to be true, mainly because I look at compatibilism and I look at the fact that we make choices and I say, okay, well, part of that choice has to do with our conceptualization of the choice. We, in our minds, are able to look at the different choices. Sure, what the end choice may be might be determined by other things, like our preference or the reasoning or the culture or the thought process that we were having at that time. But it's still a choice as far as whatever you're choosing. It's sort of like why I deny the argument against free will if God exists. Say God exists and he knows everything that you're going to do before you ever do it. And you do it exactly the way he knew you were going to do it. Do you have free will? I think you still can call what you have free will. Because of the absurdity, at least that I look at it within that argument. And that's whole, like, if I'm going to snap my fingers in about 10 seconds... If I decide I'm going to snap my fingers in about 10 seconds, and God knew I was going to snap my fingers in about 10 seconds, I couldn't stop myself. There's no way I couldn't have done that because God forced me to do it. Because he knew I was going to do it. I didn't have any will not to. That doesn't seem to make any sense to me. That seems a bit of an absurdity to me.
Yeah, the prediction isn't what makes the decision. The prediction simply tells you what decision has been made.
I believe we had this discussion before, Erlundi, but, well, it was about, well, if we have free will, like, why are we bound to the laws of nature? Why can we not, like, fly or something like that?
Or because we'll jump off a cliff and you'll see.
Yeah, there was an example that was used in one of my classes. I can't remember the exact details of the example, but was essentially Bob pushed Jim. Jim fell off a cliff. Did Jim have the free will not to fall off the cliff? No, because Jim's free will was, you can say it in two different ways. Either A, the laws of the universe are in such a way that Jim must have fallen off the cliff regardless of any sort of will that he may or may not have had, or B, he has a level of free will, but it's not powerful enough to supersede the laws of the universe in the way that they are, such as gravity and the like. So there's different ways you can look at it, and the question that philosophy tends to attack is, which one is the most substantial way, and are we even looking at the question the right way?
I see.
Currently the whole free will debate is kind of moving on to the idea of not if we have free will, but how much control we have. How much of our decision making processes is dictated by the laws of the universe and our biology, and how much of it is determined by our own thought processes in itself? What level of influence does our personal thought processes have in making decisions? Clearly, it's not the ultimate end-all, be-all, but what level is it? So that's generally what the question is being investigated as, because we have experiments where people make the decision in their head to do something a whole, like, 5 seconds before they actually do it. But we also have experiments of people making the decision to do it and then stopping themselves as they go to do it. So they made the decision to do it, they were going to do it, and as they're, like, reaching their hand out to do whatever it is they were doing, they stop and they go, oh, I'm not going to do that. So is that the level of control that we have, that we can only say no to what our biology is telling us to do? What is the level of control that we have is the question.
Isn't it, like, basically measured by conscience?
I don't know if conscience can be pulled into play as far as free will goes, mainly because would you say that one, well, not just free will, but control, since we're changing the context of control, would you say, you can easily say that a person who is unconscious has no control, but what about what's going on in their heads? What about what it is that they're dreaming? Is that something that you are controlling in any one way? Is that something that you have absolutely no control over? Because we can have experiences of people who, for instance, experience lucid dreaming, where they do, in fact, have control over the things that they are dreaming about, where they have control over their dreams in and of themselves. So if you can have that level of control, even though you're unconscious, then where does consciousness play a role in your control? Yeah, and I rhymed, and I'm hoping I don't even know it.
So if we had control of our dreams, why would we have nightmares?
Well, we don't initially. Well, I don't know. I shouldn't say not anybody does, but people in general don't initially have control over their dreams. But it's something that can be taught to us. It's something that we can condition ourselves to be able to do, either through many different exercises. Generally, the thing that's done is I'm not going to say meditate because that gets into that a lot of people have a little bit of a schism concerning that word, but you think to yourself for a certain amount of time a day and say, if I'm dreaming and I see a certain thing, I know I'm dreaming. This is real life right now. I would never see this in real life, but if I see this at all, I am dreaming. And you just think about what it is that thing is, and you just keep it in your head, and you try and pound that into your head.
A great example of that where you have you put a note in your pocket, you write something on it, and you condition yourself to, like, you know, once every 10 minutes you look at that note, and if it says something other than you wrote on it, you're dreaming.
Because one of the things that's actually been looked at, you don't even have to write anything specific, anything that you would even remember, but it has to be, it just has to be coherent words. Because when you're dreaming, the part of your brain that's capable of comprehending reading is actually not there. It's kind of shut down as you're unconscious. So if you try to read in a dream, you're not going to be able to read. It's just going to be blah. It's going to be like symbols and a bunch of things that just don't make any sense. It's going to be completely garbled.
All right.
And the point, I guess, is that once you know you're dreaming, you can take control of it.
Yeah, which is why I ask, if consciousness plays a role in our control, then why doesn't it play a role when we are unconscious?
Yeah. It's a good point.
All right. Any other points anyone's going to bring up?
Kind of just looking at stories. Oh, I wanted to pull something up real quick.
Oh, yeah.
There's been a lot of proliferation of a certain quote that may or may not have been said by the new Pope concerning women and leading. The quote, I believe, was something along the lines of, women are not built to be able to lead government, or something like that. This quote never existed, as far as anybody can track down. It's been proliferated amongst a Mexican atheist community. It's been proliferated amongst Protestants who are anti-Catholic. It's been proliferated in Europe in some places, mainly Africa in many places. But there is no actual like video or interview or anything where this quote comes from. It's just a bunch of people piggybacking off of each other based off of one person who, without any source, simply said, "Hey, the Pope said this once." That's all it is, and as such, I don't think anybody is justified in saying in attributing that quote to the Pope. You could actually go to Snopes.com. They've done an article on this already of somebody who tried to track down the quote. They couldn't find an actual source for it, so anybody who's trying to say, oh, the Pope hates women, can't really see.
Yeah, you don't need to make stuff up to find crap about the Catholic Church.
Absolutely.
Or empty condom. And anti-contraception.
Pope Pine, I'm sure he'll do it first. He'll make all the Pope himself. He don't need to make it up.
Couldn't make anything catch. You're having really bad.
I was saying, just give the Pope plenty of time, and he'll make the quote for himself.
That's usually how it works.
I'm actually currently on the Friendly Atheists blog right now, and one of his latest stories is quoting an archbishop, which is kind of Wilfred Cox Napier. He was given the question of how he refers to pedophilia as a psychological condition. And he said, "What do you do with disorders? You have to go and try and put them right. If I, as a normal being, choose to break the law knowing that I am breaking the law, then I think it should be punished. From my experience, pedophilia is actually an illness. It is not a criminal condition. It is an illness." Essentially justifying every pedophilia case ever because, they're just built that way. They can't help it. Which is weird for a Christian to say that when I'm pretty sure ones who believe in a libertarian sense of free will where we're not dictated by our psychological conditions. So, I don't know.
I know. Sorry, I'm just a bit distracted by the chat room there. But yeah, so election of the Pope comments.
Rearranging death chairs on Titanic.
Yeah. I think this guy's a hardliner as well, isn't he, apparently?
They all are, aren't they?
Yeah, but he's very much anti-gay, isn't he?
Well, they pointed that out. And if you say a Catholic is anti-gay, I guess that means anti-gay by Catholic standards.
Oh, I was going to say, he's also that the video, the evil condom guy. Hello? Anyone?
Sorry, I'm in the middle of talking.
Hang on just a second.
Yeah, did you see the video of the evil condom guy? The oh, bloody hell. Was it it's just some Catholic guy did a video on why condoms are so evil.
The Catholic Church area is an old man covered.
Yeah.
I've not seen that video. Though I'm not surprised.
Cool.
Guys, I'm afraid I have to go.
Okay, thanks for turning up, Marty.
Yeah, it was nice to actually be on a show for once.
Yeah, well,
yeah.
It's been a while since.
Yeah.
I've had so much crap to do, lots of practice and new assignment at work, so I have no time nowadays.
We'll see you next week, will we?
See you, our fellow Norwegians.
Hopefully. Oh, shut up.
see you, if I'm on in the
state. All right, see you. I'm trying to find this video. Carry on, guys. Please, someone talk.
I'm trying to read an article.
I'm addressing some people in the chat room. Apparently, the chat was cleared earlier, and one of the people is saying that we cleared the chat because apparently we're afraid of what's being said, and it's critics of us. I don't know. Usually, I know we clear the chat because it gets cluttered, and it becomes easier to read when you clear it.
Yes, basically.
That's generally the reason that's cleared, but all right.
But
if you want to go ahead and say, it's because you're afraid of me.
Yeah. I think this person's just going to accuse us of anything he feels like anyway, so.
I'd also just like to point out that, if you're afraid of this person, which is why we're inviting him on to the call. Because we're afraid of him.
So I'm still looking for this video, so keep talking, guys. I'll try and find the original of this.
This is something that always gets to me a little bit, is when somebody makes a presumption about my psyche based off of very little action done on my part. Recently it happened to me in Essence of Thought. I made a video criticizing an argument that he made, and I said, this argument is bad, and I put up the video. I didn't put it as a response to him, and I didn't let him know that I made it. So he essentially came on to the comment section and said, the reason why you didn't tell me you made this video is because you're afraid of me scrutinizing it and you don't actually have any confidence in what you're saying and you're lying. I'm like, okay, you are a psych major, so you should know not to fucking do that. You should know not to try and read people's minds over the internet. It's not a good thing for you to be doing. I just didn't tell you. I will go ahead and defend myself. I won't take down this video. Make a video if you want. He's like, I'm not making a video. I'm just telling you that you're afraid of me. I'm like, okay, fine. I don't care.
Okay, I found the video in question. So listen in. Well, we could just do a mini pony job, I suppose. So listen in to this. It's condoms are evil. Here's why.
Hi, I'm Tim Haynes of Veracast Network, which you can find at veracast.net. It occurs to me that there are a lot of Catholics who either don't know that condoms are evil or don't know why condoms are evil. I can't believe it either. So I thought I would take a minute to give you guys an explanation. Okay, Catholics, so here is the deal. Check it on out. Condoms are evil because the church says so. But if you want a better...
Okay, do we need to even comment on that? Condoms are evil because the church says so.
It's worth saying condoms are evil because I said so there.
Yeah.
Explanation that sounds a little
broad. Why does the
broad.
Church say condoms are evil? Okay, here it is. First, condoms are evil, yes, as I said, because the church said so, but really, the church teaches what God teaches. What God teaches comes to us from the gospel. One of the things that we get from the...
How big a circle is this guy going in at the moment?
How do you know that God said what God said in the gospel? How do you know it's not some other Bible?
Yeah, and I don't think it mentions condoms in the Bible at all.
Oh, no, it's in New Revelations, you know.
Yeah.
and thou must not use Durex.
Yes.
So softly specific.
What we philosophically can observe just from looking at the world around us is that there is a natural law. There is divine law, there is natural law. Mankind is required to abide by both. Our bodies are subject to the divine law, and therefore our sexuality is subject to the divine law. And speaking of your sexuality, by the way, your sexuality is not dirty. God built that into your framework. It is part of your human constitution. It comes to us from God. It is a gift.
So, okay. Is homosexuality okay then?
Evidently, if your sexuality is not dirty and it comes to you from God, then homosexuals who, from all scientific standpoints from which we can examine, most likely also comes from God, following this logic. So, anyway, one of the big things that I want to get into right now is divine law. How do you know that it's divine law? Why should we follow divine law? What is the compulsion for us to follow divine law? Why do we have to even give a crap what the divine law is? You have no way of knowing what it is. I have no reason to follow what it is. So let's just abandon it entirely. How about that?
If from God it is perfect, it is beautiful, there is nothing wrong or dirty about sex. What is wrong and dirty is how we've distorted sex, how we have misused sex, how we have perverted sex. Sex left alone is beautiful and perfect.
Hold on a second. Sex... How we have perverted sex? Hold on, I need to look something up real quick.
All right,
actually,
shall we carry on?
Actually, sex has been pretty much, well, celebrated since the dawn of man, because they actually, you could see it in cave paintings where people would, where they celebrate sex, even the ancients would do it. So pretty much perverticizing sex is nothing new.
You know, it's weird because the time we live in right now is the most sexually restricted we have ever been. You go back 2,000 years ago, fucking orgies everywhere, brothels open everywhere, people were screwing in the streets, homosexuality was rampant in gladiatorial arenas and all that kind of stuff. You go to the medieval ages, same thing, still going on, orgies everywhere, everyone is screwing, everyone's getting drunk and screwing, because that's pretty much all they could do. There wasn't a lot to do at the time. It was do your work, get drunk, screw. That's all you had time to do. That's all you knew how to do. A lot of people weren't educated, so they couldn't want to do better and bigger things. So it was like, what else is there to do?
Can I just ask, just right here for the people watching, if you have a tool meme, could it please be in Lundy saying orgies everywhere?
Orgies. Orgies everywhere.
Yeah. Carry on.
That is meddled with, or sexuality that is meddled with, becomes a distortion, it becomes a perversion. So when anything in the divine law is meddled with, or tampered with, or ruined, or changed, it leads to pain, it leads to dysfunction, it leads to disorder in the culture. And at the end of the day, that's what sin is. Sin is something that brings harm to self or others. And anything that is in conflict with God's law, divine law, natural law, anything that is in conflict with God's laws brings pain to self or others. So that's basically what sin is. Condoms are...
So if anything brings pain to others or yourself, then that violates God's law. All right, so clearly slavery is not okay according to God, right? By that logic, God's law says, hey, no slavery. Apparently the Bible didn't get that one right. And they are Catholics, so that's why I'm presuming the Bible usage here. And by the way, they also use, I believe, the King James Version. No, they use the New Living Translation, but that's still in there, so it doesn't really matter. So God's law is anything, if you break any of God's laws, that means that you are doing harm to yourself or others. Unfortunately, several of God's laws that you can find within any sort of Bible or the Quran, or pretty much any holy text include some things that do in fact do damage to others. So we have a little bit of an issue here. How do you know that that's what God's law is? How do you know that that's what sin is? Because that does not seem consistent with just about everything that I have observed from you guys.
If the God exists,
also,
then he can speak for himself.
It's the whole... Even the courts have disagreed that using condoms would bring harm. In fact, they rule the opposite, that using condoms prevents harm, because remember in Australia, just trying to remember, just off the top of my head, that they convicted a guy who intentionally slept with another woman without a condom when he was infected with HIV. And they charged him with I think it was what the charge was, but it charged him as a victim of the torture that you can pound on me.
It's just the sound's not too great from you, Kitch, today for whatever reason. Anyway, we'll carry on.
Conflict with natural law, number one, because you weren't born with a condom on, you don't need one. If you needed one, you would have been...
Okay, this is one that everyone's pointed out.
Stop it.
You're not born with a condom on, so hence you don't need it.
Okay,
can we point out these things we have on us right now? Clothes. I don't think any of us was born with these threads on.
And don't forget glasses.
Yeah.
Abandon all technology.
Glasses, hearing aids.
Arrogator.
Contacts.
With one. And number two, because condoms removes.
Yeah. Okay, and he's on to number two here.
Something that is naturally part of the sexual act. Condoms remove the procreative component from the sexual act. Effectively, it distorts the sexual act by removing a component naturally found in the sexual act. It is naturally a part of the sexual act. By removing it, you distort or pervert the act. And I'll get into why that's a bad thing in a moment. People don't just use condoms, though, to avoid getting pregnant. They also use condoms to protect themselves against sexually transmitted infections. Now, that doesn't mean that condom use is okay. I mean, a lot of people are going to argue, well, if I'm protecting myself against diseases that may kill me, why is it a bad thing? Well, it's a bad thing because if people are adhering to Catholic teaching on sexuality, they wouldn't have to worry about diseases. Sex is supposed to be between one man and one woman who are sacramentally united in matrimony. If you're using sex the way it was intended to be used, you never have to worry about viruses.
Hold on.
Now, yeah, Kitch, I'm going to ask you, is that statement true in any way? If people were monogamous, there would be no viruses. Is there any scientific truth to that statement?
No. Of course there'd be viruses.
And also...
beginning of life. Yeah.
And also that brings...
Even if that was cases like HIV can also be... transmitted via blood samples. So let's say if you're in the suspect, for example, you married, your wife needs surgery, but you get a contaminated blood transfusion has happened.
Yeah.
Is condoms then prohibited, or you're supposed to live in a sexless marriage?
I'm not sure where he's getting this whole notion that if we never used condoms, then viruses would have never been born. I don't get where that comes from.
Well, it's kind of a fluid transfer between two folks, so to me it just seems inevitable there'll be some nasty still develop from it.
And then it also brings up the problem of evil.
Yeah.
And also there's more than just transmitted viruses. You know, the common cold, flu, and rabies, going through whatever. You had viruses before condoms. Where did you get this one? Where did you decide to come up with this? Even sexually transmitted diseases were around before the Bible, or not even before.
Naturally,
there's a culture full of hypersexualized people who are having sex before marriage anyway. That doesn't mean that what's right changes. It doesn't mean that what's wrong changes. What's right and what's wrong is the same whether people agree with it, choose to abide by it, or not. Therefore, condom use, which is evil by its nature, remains evil even if people decide it's not really how they're going to live.
I knew you'd be rearing for this one.
So, condoms are evil by their very nature, and we've established this because if you didn't use condoms, then viruses would have never been made, but condoms are the only ways to stop viruses attracted to STDs and how they are transmitted. However, I would have to ask the question, If condoms are evil because it's some sort of sin to use them, I have to ask if sin, as was earlier defined, is the harm of yourself or others, and condoms protect yourself and others from harm, how then is it evil? It seems by your own definition we ought to use condoms because they do not cause damage to ourselves or others. So, yeah, we have a little bit of an issue with your consistency, my dear friend.
Their lives. Yeah. So in short, condom use is evil because it distorts the sexual act and because it conditions people to utilize sex strictly for gratification. Sex is unitive and procreative by its nature.
Stop! Sex
evolved sex evolved the way it has because we want to do it. If we didn't want to have sex, if it wasn't the way, the way sex is, fantastic. Then, if sex didn't evolve to feel, so fantastic for the gratification, then, it wouldn't have evolved. It wouldn't have gone. It would have had no advantage apart from the increasing genetic diversity. That's the reason why it evolved. Because it was so fantastic. It evolved that way, if I'm making any sense. I hope I am. Quarter to four in the morning here.
It's fun. It feels good. The joy of sex is one of the fruits of our sexuality. The fruits of our sexuality aren't intended to be the root of our sexuality. It's the result of our sexuality. And when the culture is using it as the root of sexuality, when we're just using our sexuality to have a good time, things get turned upside down in the culture. Now, I said before that when you
Stop.
Okay, so even when you have sex without a condom, it's not a guarantee that you're going to conceive anyway. So if the only purpose of sex is to conceive a child and you don't even conceive a child every time you have sex, then why is that the case? It seems to be a bit of an issue. The other thing that I want to point out, yet again, I cannot stress this enough. The current time that we live in, the culture that we live in, is the most under-sexualized culture that has ever existed. You can even go back to the 50s, back when everybody thought it was all Leave It to Beaver. That never existed. That whole Leave It to Beaver whole thing where everybody was innocent and nobody knew what sex was and everything was all hunky-dory never existed. That was never true. Drug use was much higher back then. Murder was much higher back then. Prostitution was much higher back then. And racism, all higher back then. All of this stuff was awful back then, and it's only been getting better these days. So to say we currently live in a hypersexualized culture is meaningless if we've always had a culture that is more sexualized than this one. So now it's a problem, but it wasn't a problem before. No, it was a problem before too.
Stored something's nature, it's a sin, and the nature of sin is that it hurts self or others. So here's how that applies to condom use. Sex, as I said, is unitive and procreative by its nature. Using a condom not only changes its nature, but it conditions us to consistently misuse sexuality for something other than it was naturally intended. Now, where has...
Stop in this voice. Seriously, guy? Condom is evil?
Yeah.
Because
the purpose of sex is just to have kids, and if you're not having kids, then that's awful. I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Okay. He said that's a stupid point. We are not born with condom. You are not born with clothes. You are not born with computer. You are not born with anything. What's wrong with you? The second thing. Condom. It does. If you don't use condom, that doesn't mean. Or if you have one-to-one relationship, that doesn't mean the virus and the bacteria. It's not transferred from you to your partner. It doesn't matter if you have one partner or you have multi-partner. In both sides, if you carry. Any virus in your body will transfer to your partner. It doesn't matter if that partner is one, if that partner with the paper of marriage. Paper doesn't protect you, stupid guy. That condom protects you. And the other issue, I have right to decide what time it's right to bring baby in my life. I don't want just bring baby in the wrong time, in the wrong condition, in the wrong environment. And who said we don't have right? Yeah, go ahead. Sketch.
I just want to also follow on what Africa said. I just want to follow on with a good conversation from what Jay just said, and that if you give women control over the rate at which they reproduce, you improve the quality of life for that society. And condoms are one such way of doing that.
Okay, carry on.
Is that lead? That has led to sexually transmitted diseases going from merely 20 in the 40s and 50s to over 160 today. The CDC recently released a study in which they report that there are 20 million new STI infections each and every year.
Yeah, I think he's not really giving any background to what these statistics, like percentage-wise of population.
I'm not too sure of where he's getting these statistics from, but that's not the point.
He says it's the CDC.
But I just want to also point out, I'm not sure if it's really important, but I just want to point out that the amount of diseases, infectious diseases that we know, is also going up. So, is the amount of STDs increasing because or is it because we just aren't finding out more and more diseases?
Basically, there's just more disease, basically, isn't there?
No, that is...
And also, diseases evolve and change.
Yeah. It's not increase.
But just the diseases we know about.
Go ahead.
So, I'm saying, like, basically, what you're saying is the amount of diseases we know about has increased. Like, what we're aware of.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, so I was just trying to distill that point.
And the other issue... There is so dangerous issue here. If you tell to young people, condom is evil and don't use it, they will go to non-safety sexual act, and they will destroy their life, and they will just distribute the disease everywhere. That's so dangerous and bad. We should tell the young people how to use condom and the kind of the condom. I study in my college, give us complete course complete chapter about just use condom, how use condom, the kind of the condom.
I mean,
is a condom for oral sex, and there is a condom for if you have disease, another kind, and there is a condom for if you just want foreplay, there is another condom. So there is a lot of kind of condom. If someone has disease, any kind of disease, should use a specific condom. That condom included kill sperm. This is very important, guys.
Right. I'm just noticing.
You should check this one.
Yeah, we're just noticing we don't have much time left, so we'll have to really hit the points quick and hard for the unintentional innuendo there. Yeah. We're gonna have to hit this quick and hard.
We can't be premature now.
Yes. All right.
Oh, yeah, and I will say this video is starting to sound like the abstinence program I used to have in my school.
Okay, let's go for it.
20 million. And that's just in the United States. Condom use also has made little or no dent on the rate of accidental or unplanned pregnancies in the American culture. This is also substantiated by the CDC. The problem is, using condoms changes our conditioning. It conditions us to utilize sex as something that is pleasure-giving, right? We get pleasure, we give pleasure, but really it's about the getting pleasure. And because we think condoms are making us safe, we tend to do it more often, right?
I just stop it right there. Yeah, I just noticed there, I don't know if there have been enough of it, but it's on a selfish act, you know, it's about getting pleasure. But that's bullshit. If anyone actually has been in a relationship, it's also about, you know, wanting to please the other girl. You know, the girl or the guy or whoever. And, that's bullshit. Because, you know, has anyone ever come out of sex and just like, oh, that was great for me, but you know, you wonder,
well,
she was satisfied or he was satisfied.
Well, what he's saying there, it doesn't make any difference to unwanted pregnancy rates. I think it's been shown that pregnancy rates are highest in, I think Latin America's got one of the highest pregnancy rates, doesn't it? And it's usually in, and if you notice, like...
Where abstinence only education involved to have the higher pregnancy rate.
Yeah.
So I'll need to look that up.
Well, basically, yeah, it's not that condoms are just the only way to have safe sex. It's one of the ways. There's a whole lot more. It's just educating people on all the methods available to them.
I just want to say two things real quick. Firstly, as far as giving people pleasure and receiving pleasure, really it's all about the receiving. I've actually been told by a few people that I'm a very unselfish lover. Okay, so please don't project your selfish loving tendencies onto me, because I personally enjoy giving pleasure more than giving pleasure. I get pleasure from giving pleasure. So thank you very much, sir.
Yes.
And the other thing I really want to say.
I just want to check what Pale Swag said there. That's actually quite a very true thing. He said, it's not safe sex, it's safer sex. Because, you know, you'll never be 100% safe in anything you do.
Yeah, and I just want to point out something about the consistency of this video from this guy. So in the beginning, he says that sex is good and sex is great and something that's given to you by God. There's nothing dirty about sex, but you should never do it until you get married. And you can only do it with one person, and you should only do it for procreational purposes. And you shouldn't want to get any pleasure from it, because that's a selfish thing. So never.
Yeah.
So all the things about sex that are good, that are natural within us, no, that's all bad. Don't do that. That's you perverting what it is. It's totally okay, but it's not okay.
So condom use actually enables promiscuity.
I have this point
so we
to
see
say
the change
because it's very important.
We've got to be really quick. We're running out of time.
Okay. Please, when you use condom, don't use oil, not solve in water. There is a lot of kind of oils. If you use oil, not solve in water, or not, if you use oil, it's not specific for condoms. You will make condoms. It is like not safety as should be. Okay, be careful. What you use, how you use, condom for your safety. So use it as should be.
Okay.
Distorting the inherent nature of sexuality has led to cultural disorder. Unless you think rampant accidental pregnancies and the quadrupling of sexually transmitted infections is a good thing. Not to mention what a distorted sexuality does to our sense of commitment to another person. Have you looked at the divorce rate in this country lately? It's not good. So in short, condom use is evil because, number one, it changes the intrinsic...
Yeah, and it's higher among religious people.
Of human sexuality. Number two, that is a violation of natural law. Number three, when mankind violates natural law, it results in disorder. All of this is observable in the culture. Now, you may or may not agree with the church's teachings. That is on you. You now know what the church teaches and why. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, moans, gripes, complaints, if you want to say, nice job, Tim, or hey, Tim, I disagree with you, don't just leave a comment. You know, at Veracast Network, the podcast goes on the air.
Okay, and I'd like to point out, this guy has basically blocked everyone that disagrees with him. No matter how and this is people quoting CDC statistics. If you don't know, go to Fishhead Salad is the guy, this is the user's name. He's done a rebuttal where he's got the full CDC report, and this guy's bullshitting. And basically, he's been blocking everyone that disagrees with him.
And also, can I just comment? If you also want to comment, here's a comment. If you don't play the game, don't make the fucking rules.
Yep. So that's that. That's a miniature live pony there we managed to squeeze in. And we're almost out of time. So thank you, everyone, for turning up. It's big thanks to Hemant, first of all, for being our guest. And like I say, he just had other things to do. But thanks to him for giving us an hour of his time. He was awesome. So
he was a friendly atheist.
He was. He lived up to his name. So I think I'll just go through my co-host, just final words. Kitch, final words, please.
I just want to say thank you to the friendly atheist for turning up. And people, please do these things.
Yes.
If you're going to have, because they are, you know, fantastic. And they're coming in a lot of different varieties and a lot of different flavors.
And, Kitch, I think we'll be seeing... You're going to be returning in May proper to the show, if I remember right.
Yeah, I'll see if I can come on between now and then, but it looks like it's probably going to be May.
Yeah.
When I come back.
Okay, and Lundy, final thoughts?
The Catholic Church's position on condoms is stupid. I think that's inarguable, and anybody who says it's not stupid, they're wrong. Abstinence does not count as safe sex because by definition it's no sex. Let's see. Friendly Atheist is a pretty cool guy as far as talking to him. I may disagree with some of his policies, but yeah, now I would have a beer with him. And our chat room was very lovely today.
Yes.
So there you go.
And Casey, just any words from you?
Protect biodiversity and make the pledge to not remain abstinent.
Oh, and Lundy, do you have the link for Colin's video just to put that in the chat room for everyone? Like I say, check
it out. I put it in there earlier, but I'll put it in there again. It's a very well done video, two hours long, so make sure you have time to watch it. Very well researched. I believe that's it.
Yeah, I've always said I think Colin's actually one of the best skeptics I've actually come across for how he analyzes, these claims. He's very level-headed, and he really kind of just... He's very cool and calm about things. You've got a lot of respect for Colin.
Yeah, I do too. Especially, like, what attracted me to him was when he would debunk environmental skepticism.
Yeah, that's his kind of hobby horse. And also, just to remind everyone, go below in the playground, because next week we're on, and it's going to be our last ever show on Blog TV, and then we're going to be moving over to Vaughan Live for the foreseeable future, because as we know, Blog TV on the 27th of March is going to be no more. They've merged, so they say, with you now, but you know, we're not going to bash them on here. Like, Blog TV have been great hosts. It's been an awesome website, but sadly, it's going to be no more. So we're moving to Vaughan Live. Good thing about Vaughan Live is, unlike you now, where Blog TV is moving, you don't need to log in with Facebook. You just need an email address. So we look forward to seeing everyone there. And we're back next week with Teresa McBain. I take it you know who Teresa McBain is, or do I need to give a quick recap?
Give a quick recap.
Yeah, Teresa McBain, last year, it was at the American Atheist Conference. She'd been kind of she'd been posting on American Atheist under a pseudonym. Basically, as a pastor, that was going to come out. She came out of the conference, and then she lost her job straight away. And she's basically... And